Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly performing arts magazine. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with Warren Stewart about Magnificat's upcoming performances. Ellie Shapiro talks about the Jewish Music Festival. We'll also hear about Word for Word's production of Alice Munro's stories, The Office and Dolly, and the Theater Rhinoceros production of Breaking the Code, the Alan Turing story, currently playing at the Eureka Theater. Music critic Janosch Garabin will stop by as well with some highlights of some upcoming performances. Stay with us. The marvelous music of Marc-Antoine Charpentier. Two of his oratorios on stories of powerful Old Testament women will be presented by Magnificat this weekend. Warren Stewart, the director of Magnificat, joins me once again in studio, accompanied, as it were, by one of the featured soloists this weekend, Andrew Rader. Warren is one of the most dynamic and engaging early music specialists in the country today, and the concerts he presents under the Magnificat aegis bring together some of the finest early music players available anywhere. Warren is also a cellist and was artistic director of the California Bach Society for 7 years, and has appeared as a guest conductor with the San Antonio Symphony and Sonoma County Bach Society. Warren, it's hard to believe it's been a whole 2 months since we've last seen each other and talked here on the air.
It's great to see you again, David.
And bad planning on one of our parts here, because I'm going to be away this weekend for these performances, and I'll have to miss these performances. Countertenor Andrew Rader is a member of Lieber Ensemble for Early Music and has performed with ensembles throughout the United States and Europe. In addition, he has been involved in numerous solo and choral performances and is also a founding member and co-director of Harmonia Speculum, a chamber vocal ensemble formed in 2009, which is geared towards bridging the gap between antiquity and present day through chant melodies and texts. Welcome to you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the wonderful music of Marc-Antoine Charpentier. Tell us about him.
Well, Charpentier is one of our favorites. We've done programs of music by Charpentier almost every season for a couple decades now. And I am especially pleased with these works that we're doing. They're not performed very often, and they're among the very first works that he wrote in the what we call oratorio style, what he would have called histoire sacrée, or sacred stories. Charpentier is an interesting character because he's very French, but he studied in Italy with Giacomo Carissimi, who was the most respected composer of oratorios at the time. And he brought that dramatic intensity of Italy back and set it basically with a French accent, if you will. So these are works that he wrote for the ensemble in the household that he lived in. He was writing for people that he ate breakfast with and basically spent his time with. So there's a sort of familiarity that I find very appealing in the music. And the music is very subtle and has lots of nuance that perhaps is because he knew his musicians so intimately.
Mm. Is that maybe the reason why also the music of Charpentier compared to, you know, countless other Baroque composers has risen as the cream to the top of the Baroque repertoire?
Well, he's a very interesting character because he was discovered quite late, really only after the second half of the 20th century.
Really?
And we were very fortunate that we have any music of Charpentier at all because he didn't publish anything during his life. But he, throughout his career, kept notebooks in which he made fair copies of everything. Well, I don't know everything he wrote, but certainly most of the works that he wrote are in these notebooks in chronological order through 30 years. And fortunately, almost all of those notebooks survive and were sold by his heirs to what is now the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris.
Where they probably languished for years and years.
Where they sat for over two centuries.
Wow.
Until the 1950s when they started. There were a few pieces that were performed. The Te Deum, the Prelude to Te Deum, is actually
the theme
song for the Eurovision Song Contest.
Oh.
is familiar from that. And his Midnight Mass, which is based on Christmas carols, is done quite a bit. But nothing else was done at all. And over the last 20, 30 years, several groups have been performing and recording his music, and we're one of those. We're big fans. So he definitely deserves to be performed as much as possible. He's a wonderful composer. Well, didn't write a bad note.
Well, it's intriguing, though. It makes me wonder what other hidden piles are in these libraries in Paris and other great capitals of the world.
One hopes there's lots more to find.
And there's you've been a big part of that Indiana Jones discovery period.
We've been fortunate to be able to bring a lot of works to light that really deserve to be heard.
Mm-hmm. So are these the only two works that he wrote on these historical old figures?
On these two in particular, yes. He also wrote many other oratorios on different biblical subjects, of course. Mm-hmm. But these two were very among the first two, maybe even the first two that he wrote in the 1670s. And they, his patron was a patroness, and she was very interested in works about women.
Mm-hmm. So. I'd like to bring Andrew Rader into the conversation here. Andrew, I'm wondering what attracted you to the countertenor repertoire?
Well, I started out singing as a tenor, and much like the sort of famous David Daniels story, it just wasn't working at the top of the voice, and so we started exploring options, and this worked very well. My best friend's also a countertenor, who I met during my undergraduate years, and he said, you know, maybe you should try this. So I went to my voice teacher, and it worked out very well. And this repertoire, the French repertoire in particular, is one of the traditions where it has sort of existed, you know, throughout. The tenor parts have always been rather high, and so they're high for tenors, low for altos, you know. And in this particular case, it's wonderful because Charpentier wrote. Was a countertenor, an haut cantre in this case, is what the French call it. And this is actually his part that I'm getting to sing in these concerts, which is really quite wonderful. It's just fantastic.
So talk to us a little bit about the physical process, then, of singing countertenor. It's not just a matter of singing in falsetto.
Sure, right. I think a lot of countertenors that will start out that way, and then with good training, you bring in a more fundamental core to the voice. It's actually not dissimilar to a female mezzo-soprano approach. With the French repertoire, there's a lot more lower chest involvement, but in the Italian and German repertoire, it's pretty standard, like a mezzo-soprano.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I'm wondering if you, for our audience that might not be familiar with what a countertenor sounds like, could you offer us an example of singing in the different ranges so we know what a real countertenor... We've got to get your voice prepared a little bit for this. I can add a little Carnegie Hall if that's helpful.
You go from sort of the speaking register, which is what most people... we would think of as the typical tenor baritone, you know, ha-ha-ha-ha kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on up to, you know, if we go higher, it's ah, you know, it's a mixture. It's not, so to speak, full voice ever above that, because, you know, the physiology is a little strange in that the entire vocal mechanism is not vibrating 100%, but we strive for, you know, in the 80s sort of range, coming over from the center of the vocal folds. But the idea of registrational shifts being color shifts in the voice is very important, especially in Baroque music, Baroque and classical music. So you'll have things where there's these large leaps. You know, you'll come all the way down into it. And it's just a very bizarre experience to try to work out those little twists and turns.
And also from this period, obviously very florid as well. I mean, you've got
sure. You know, I find for my own repertoire, the male alto repertoire, that's the floridness comes much more from the Italian school than the French. The French is much more straightforward, beautiful melodies, you know, which you also get in the Italian school, but the Italians are a little more fiery in this case.
Well, shame on Warren for not having some recorded examples of you to play. It's nice to hear the technique's about, at least.
I brought some examples of the sopranos because, of course, the two main pieces on the program feature, in one case, Catherine Webster will be Judith, or Judith, as it would be pronounced by the French, and Laura Himes is Esther. In the other. So I have an example of each of them singing with us. First, I believe first is Catherine Webster.
And she'll be singing what?
This is a very beautiful brief aria from the Nativity Pastorale of Charpentier, which we performed in December of 2012.
Music of Marc-Antoine Charpentier, and then more with Warren Stewart of Magnificat. There, and prior to that, Catherine Webster, two of the soloists that will be singing more of the music of Marc-Antoine Charpentier from the powerful Old Testament women Esther and Judith, presented by Magnificat. Warren Stewart, director of that ensemble, joins me in the studio with another one of the soloists that will be featured, Andrew Rader. Great stuff. Boy, that's amazing writing. I mean, you can tell how it has really...
It's very lush harmonies. I find really beautiful, gorgeous harmonies, and a real attentiveness to the text. Very sometimes word by word, following the emotion and the character of the dramatic action. So, he's a wonderful composer.
Mm. These performances will be Friday at St. Mark's Episcopal Church on Colorado Avenue. Berkeley on Saturday at the First Congregational Church on Channing Way, and then Sunday at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, a great space for this type of music. Yeah. Information at magnificatbaroque.com. I wish you wonderful performances. I'm anxious to hear these stories in oratorio. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Andrew Rader, thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you.
You brought us another example. What is the music we're going to go out with of Charpentier?
This is the opening, the sort of overture to the Descent of Orpheus to the Underworld, which is another oratorio that Charpentier wrote, and we performed this in 2011. So this is just the, this it's still happy here. We haven't gotten to, he hasn't gotten to the Underworld yet, so.
Thanks again for coming in.
You bet.
Music of Marc-Antoine Charpentier. You'll hear it in oratorio form this weekend by Magnificat. Magnificatbaroque.com, under the direction of Warren Stewart, will be presenting two oratorios on two powerful Old Testament women, Esther and Judith, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Information at Magnificatbaroque.com. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Still to come, we'll be talking with the folks involved in Breaking the Code, the Alan Turing story at the Theater Rhinoceros. Kirsten Peacock, the assistant director, and one of the actors will be with me for that. We'll also hear about the Jewish Music Festival. Janosch Garabin will share some cultural highlights of the month to come. And next, well, another welcome repeat organization represented on this week's Open Air, the good people at Word for Word. Word for Word at Z Below on Florida Street presents the company's full theatrical production for the year, stories by Alice Munro, The Office, and Dolly, under the direction of Joel Mullinex through April 12th. Actor Susan Harlow, who was also co-founder of Word for Word in 1993, joins me in studio to talk about the production, along with co-artistic director Jerry Lynn Cohen. Susan, Jerry Lynn, welcome to Open Air.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Well, let's first talk about the mission of Word for Word, which is a little bit different from most theatrical companies, isn't it?
Right. Well, our deal is that we perform short stories in their entirety. So we're a fully theatrical professional theater company, and Joanne Winter, who is co-founder of Word for Word, and I founded this in 1993. And since then, we've probably performed over... brought to full production over 90 short stories by great, great writers like Amy Tan, Tobias Wolff, Richard Ford, Joanne Greenberg, Mavis Galan. I could go on and on. And Alice Munro.
Interesting. Now, how did Alice Munro fit into this this format then? I mean, she's still a living writer. Mm-hmm. I believe she's still productive at 83 up in Ontario.
Yeah. Yeah.
A prolific writer of short stories.
Yes.
So the challenge must have been finding... which ones to present.
That is exactly right. That's exactly what it was. You know, we had performed a story of hers in 1999, I think, right, Jerry Lynn? 1999.
Yes.
Friend of My Youth. And then, since then, many others. And then she won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2013. And she's the first short story writer ever to receive that award. And we'd been thinking of her all these years, of course, because we're all avid readers. But that Nobel Prize went blink, 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 boing, boing, boing. Okay, let's do Alice Munro again. And so we read a lot of the short stories. I mean, you were here more for that.
We read a lot of stories. We read a lot. And when we find things that we like, the next step is to read it out loud. And once we all agree on something that we read out loud, because something that you read on the page doesn't always lend itself to production. You really have to hear it out loud. And then we do something that we call off the page, which is a workshop towards production. And this time we actually put ourselves out on a limb and we brought the audience in. And we did four off the page productions of different Alice Munro stories, and we let the audience choose.
We asked them to vote on their favorites, and happily for everybody, their choice was also ours. And what's
no split decision, Supreme Court involved.
No hanging chads, nothing like that. But what's great about this particular selection, as it turns out, is that it's one of Alice Munro's very first short stories from her first collection of short stories, Dance of the Happy Shades, plus Dolly, which is one of her most recent short stories from her latest collection of short stories, Dear Life. So we're looking at, in a sense, a span of a writer's life, a span of a woman's life. The very nature of the two stories shows us that.
The stories are very personal. Mm-hmm. I think that when we did Friend of My Youth back in 1999, although there are elements of that story that I can see are personal, I think that it's a much bigger story. It's a short story that actually reads like a novel in terms of the world and the time passing.
Well, let's talk a little bit specifics about these stories then, The Office and Dolly. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to turn The Office over to Jerry Lynn to discuss, because she is, in fact, the prime mover.
I'm always like, don't call her the writer.
Don't call her the housewife. She's not named. Her character, Jerry Lynn's character, is not named. Both these stories, by the way, are written in the first person, which is really a tough thing for the division of line division for actors, et cetera. Anyway,
it is. As a company, we always try to stay away from stories that are written in the first person.
But there's
so
many good ones. So
yeah, yeah.
Tell us about The Office, Jerry Lynn.
The Office. Well, I have to say that I personally was drawn to this story from the very beginning because it's something, as a woman, not just as a woman, even though that's a huge part of it, but as an artist, that I responded to. It's written in the voice of somebody who's asking to be taken seriously at a time when women weren't taken seriously as writers. So when people say, what do you do? And you say you're a writer, people don't know how to respond. You know, that the women were expected in the late 50s, early 60s to say, oh, I'm a wife and I'm a mother. And if you're not, then
you're a secretary or a nurse.
Right. Right. So it's her. The story is really her struggle to find her voice as an individual.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of voice did she discover in herself?
Well, you don't really find that answer the story. I think the question is still hanging. But I think what you do find is a very particular voice in her head. I think at one point she uses the line, and I tried out a very cold voice that is to be heard frequently in my thoughts, but has great difficulty getting out of my cowardly mouth.
That's Jerry Lynn Cohen, featured in The Office as one of two Alice Munro stories being presented by Word for Word through April 12th, zspace.org for more information. Also joined by actress Susan Harlow, who was also the co-founder of Word for Word back in 1993. So the other story being Dolly. Would you like to take that one, Susan?
The other story, yes, is Dolly. And as I said, it's in her most recent collection. Some say, she says, it's her last collection of stories. We hope it's not. But it's the story of another unnamed woman who is in a really great place in her life with her poet, unofficial husband, partner. And the story begins with their kind of very coolly and intellectually planning what their end of life, what's going to happen, you know, how will they die, and will they die together, and maybe they'll plan it out. And but no cremation, no, that's popular with their friends, but not what they want. So it's just sort of this, as Alice Munro is, as she writes, this sort of bizarre, funny, you can't quite believe it, but very almost normal scene. And the woman feels that something's missing. Something's not passionate enough there. Something is. She wishes for more to happen in their lives, for there to be more to come. They are 71 and 83, and she wishes for more to come. Can it really be done? And then, into their life comes a person. And I don't want to talk any more about that because I don't want to spoiler this story.
Right. Well, there's a teaser for you. All right?
You're right. I think that what to me, Dolly, why I love this story so much is because it shows us that passion and love and jealousy and betrayal are alive in all of us through the end of our lives. It's just as Jerry Lynn was speaking about the role of women. I'm speaking about ageism in a sense here because, you know, love and lust and all of those things don't end if you turn 50 or 60. I don't know about 70, but I'm guessing not. It doesn't for these characters. These things are still happening.
Well, and for 80, for that matter, for Alice Munro, I'm sure.
Right.
Exactly right.
Were you in touch at all with her about these?
No, we've been in touch with her agent, of course, to get the permission. But she, long ago we learned when we performed Friend of My Youth, we invited her to come and see it. We've had a lot of different writers come and see their work performed by us. But we were told she just didn't want to leave her writing. And so we're respecting that now, especially. I mean, she didn't even go to Stockholm to accept the Nobel.
Oh, my gosh.
She was interviewed in Canada for that.
But I will say that we have been invited to Toronto, and we will be performing in Toronto, which is near where she lives. And
you could always just go stalk her, you know?
She'd love that. You can see from the video.
We're hoping our Canadian producer will reach out, and who knows?
Maybe a nice cup of tea or something.
Toronto's closer than San Francisco.
That's
right.
For sure.
That's right.
So, you know, as prolific as Alice Munro is, chances are you're going to move on to another author for the 2016 presentation of Word for Word. What might be in the works for you guys?
Well, we're looking at Edward P. Jones, and he's a fantastic writer. He's got numerous books, but one is All Aunt Hagar's Children, and there's the title story we're interested in, and we're just now talking with the Lorraine Hansberry Theater about a collaboration of some sort with them, and we're really, really excited to bring that one to its feet, as we say. We're also looking at
Colm Toybean.
Right. And Damon Runyon, as a matter
actually.
Of fact, too. Right.
Well, that'd be kind of fun.
Yeah. I know. Well, thanks for saying so.
Yeah.
We think so.
Yeah.
We think so.
In the meantime, you can catch the stories of Alice Munro, The Office, and Dolly at ZSpace, Word for Word. Susan Harlow, Jerry Lynn Cohen, thanks so much for coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More information about these performances at ZSpace at zspace.org. The performances run through April 12th. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Well, keeping on the theatrical end of things, we're going to speak with one of the people involved in the Alan Turing story, Breaking the Code. Kirsten Peacock's going to be talking about that program. Also, we're going to have a little preview of the Jewish Music Festival, and critic Janosch Garabin is still standing by for a little segment on things to come on the music scene here in San Francisco. Well, the story of Alan Turing has received a lot of attention as of late, thanks to the spectacular performance by Benedict Cumberbatch in the Academy Award-winning film The Imitation Game, which won the Oscar for Best Writing and Adapted Screenplay. A theatrical version of the story is being presented at Theater Rhinoceros, Breaking the Code, the Alan Turing story, as penned for the stage by Hugh Whitemore. For this limited engagement through March 21st at the Eureka Theater on Jackson Street, John Fisher will portray Alan Turing. John, also executive director of Theater Rhino since 2002, is also directing this production. Another multiple hat-wearing person associated with the play is Kirsten Peacock, who joins me today in studio to talk about the production. Kirsten is the assistant director of the show and also plays the role of Pat, who is based on Turing's one-time fiancée, Joan Clark. Thereby hangs a tale, I'm sure. This will make the third production that Miss Peacock, who comes to us from merry old England, has worked with John Fisher on that are based on historical events. Kirsten Peacock, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much.
Now, for those listening that are either have been living under a rock or are history challenged, perhaps you could share with us a little bit about the Alan Turing story.
Absolutely. Alan Turing was a physicist and a mathematist, and during the war he was taken in by the government code and cipher school to help break the Enigma, which was a machine that the Nazis were using in order to send communication, to send codes, all of their communication during the war. And he helped to devise a machine that helped break this code. It was kept under huge secrecy for years and years. And after the war, he carried on with this machine at Manchester University. He kept on creating and building it. And I guess that was the beginnings of what we use now as a computer. Unfortunately, his story doesn't have a very happy ending. He was convicted of gross indecency because he was found out for being homosexual, and he was given drug treatments, which left him in not a very good place. And in the end, he committed suicide.
That is quite a story. Mm. Now, what aspect of Alan Turing's life is explored in this stage version by Mr. Whitmore?
Whitmore, yes. Whitmore. Mm-hmm. Was very well thought out, actually. It sort of explores everything. It explores mainly his relationships with the most important people in his life, I'd like to think. And it sort of goes from young age of 17 to what could potentially be after his death, or which is after his death, actually. There's definitely a scene of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you enter the role as a one-time fiancé.
Yes.
So there must be a lot of tension involved in your role.
Yes, there is. I think for several reasons. Pat Green, who's originally based on the character Joan Clark in real life, was his one-time fiancé in this play. Well, we'll see how that turns out. But she was a bit of an outsider as well. Very, very smart woman. Got a double first degree in mathematics from Cambridge, which was very rare in those days, especially for a woman. She went to the government code and cipher school, and she was the only girl in Hut 8. Very intelligent. And, I suppose she fell in love with Alan Turing, and she wanted to marry him. And unfortunately, things didn't exactly work out.
Well, exactly, yeah. So, speaking of tensions, now you're assistant director to this show, playing the role of Pat, and you're working with John Fisher, who you're also acting with, and he's the director. Are there any kind of cross signals? Is there a hierarchy of, no, you shouldn't do this, you should do that?
No. John is an incredible man, has a very clear idea of how he wants things done, and I hope that I can just help him augment what he wants. And I've been able to act as more of an outside eye, because, of course, he's in every single scene, so I've been able to give a little bit of feedback in that case, but there's never been any clashes or tension or dramatic fights, thankfully.
Well, what's nice, too, is that you've worked with him on two other historical plays. What were those?
The first one I did with him was Ishi, The Last of the Yahi, and that was in 2012, I want to say, in March this time, actually. I was playing the role of Saxton. That was based on a true story about the last Yahi that sort of came out of the wild and just gave up and gave himself over to UC or to Berkeley University. And it was a very interesting story that sort of followed him and followed their process of how they studied him and a lot of the information they got from him and how important he was in developing a lot of information about their cultural life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the second play I did was The Battle of Midway, which was this just past December, November and December. It was about the Battle of Midway. It was a campy musical, and it was an extravaganza of lights and all sorts. It was wonderful.
Well, Whitmore mm-hmm. is also... he uses a lot of historical background for a lot of the work he's done, not only in television, but for plays. Mm-hmm. Were you familiar with his work as a fellow Brit at all?
I actually wasn't, but I know a lot of the people in the cast were. Pack of Lies is something that we've talked about a lot and how interesting that story is. And,
Okay, and speaking of the cast, tell us who else is in the cast.
Wonderful. We have a fabulous cast of... Our equity actor is Val Hendrickson. He's wonderful. He's going to be playing Knox, who's this lovely eccentric character. We've got Michael DiMartini, Justin Lucas, who I've worked with before, Celia Maurice, Heron Patel, Patrick Ross, and that's about it in the cast.
Mm-hmm. And the performances are at the Rhino Theater on Eureka Street here in San Francisco. The performances are at
Eureka Theater.
Eureka Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
I get my Eurekas and Auroras mixed up here.
Be on the wrong side of the bay in that case.
Yeah, indeed. That would be a problem if you went over there and expected that. But all the information is at therhino.org. Mm-hmm. Performances through March 21st, featuring John Fisher, not only directing, but as Alan Turing. Now, you're not going to see a play version of the movie you may be familiar with, but you will definitely see an aspect of Alan Turing that's worth being told. And I thank Kirsten Peacock for coming in to telling us a little bit about that.
Thank you very much.
Again, information for Breaking the Code, the Alan Turing story, at therhino.org, now through the 21st of March. Open Air, David Latulip with you. We're going to be talking with Janos Gerbin about some things coming up of cultural interest on his radar, and now a little bit of a music prelude of the Jewish Music Festival. The Klezmatics, which you can hear tonight as opening night of the 30th and final Jewish Music Festival, which runs through the 22nd of March. They'll be performing in Oakland at the New Parish on 18th Street tonight at 8, the Klezmatics. Here to talk about the Jewish Music Festival, its 30th season, and apparently its final, is someone who's been involved with the festival since 1998, Ellie Shapiro. Ellie, thanks for coming in, and you got to first tell me why this is the last one.
Oh, it's
long, sad story.
Well, I think we're a victim of our own success, frankly, because when we started doing Jewish music and having it, we were the first Jewish music festival in the United States when we started in 1986, and since then, more and more venues present Jewish music. It's no longer a people
fringe thing.
Doing
it's more,
it.
More common. That's great.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished. That's super.
Yeah.
So this festival is a celebration then of 30 years of doing this festival. What's happening over the course of these next couple of weeks?
Well, we wanted some of our most favorite, and my most favorite has always been the Klezmatics. They're Grammy-winning ensemble that has been together over 20 years, and for me, they're like the dead, you know, in that they just got tighter and tighter and tighter over the years and continually have recreated themselves. They are so eclectic and so creative and innovative that it's always a joy to listen to them. And this is going to be a very special performance because it's in a small venue. A New Parish for a sit-down concert is a small venue. It's for dance. It can fit more. But we wanted an intimate setting to hear a band this great. So it's a rare, rare opportunity. They play huge, you know, for thousands of people in huge halls. So to get to see them in the New Parish tonight is going to be a very special experience.
You've also got Kitka coming in on Sunday. They've performed here live. We've had them as guests. It's a fantastic ensemble.
Kitka is amazing. And what's very exciting about that performance, they'll be doing a mix of more traditional and Yiddish-oriented songs. But also, we are honoring Ronnie Gilbert, who was from the pioneering folk music revival group called The Weavers. Ronnie's about 88, so she's not singing anymore, but her memoir is about to come out within the month from UC Press. And we're thrilled to be able to honor her as part of the Kitka concert on Sunday, March 8th at the Freight.
Nice. Now, something's happening as part of the festival that kind of caught my eye, and I'm sure will catch people's ears. The Paul Hansen Ensemble, one of the leading jazz bassoonists. Now, that's something you don't hear often in the same sentence, jazz bassoonist.
Right. He's really forged a new sound for this concert instrument, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous sound. He's a master improviser and virtuoso on the instrument, and he came to me, actually, after spending 4 years in Japan with Cirque du Soleil. And when he was in Japan, living in a homogeneous culture, he became more sensitive to his own cultural roots, which are Jewish and Berkeley, and came to me wanting to somehow find expression for that journey of roots that he was on through music. So since 2007, we've been commissioning new music, and we're excited to be able to present a world premiere on Wednesday, March 11th at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. And it's Paul Hansen's ensemble, and the name of the show is Homecoming.
Very nice. Well, let's have a little sample of some jazz bassoon. This is Paul Hansen performing, and then more with Ellie Shapiro about the 30th and final Jewish Music Festival. Jazz bassoonist in that excerpt, Emerald Mile, from his album Un Polaris. Paul Hansen will be doing a world premiere of a work this next Wednesday, the 11th, at the Freight and Salvage as part of the Paul Hansen Ensemble Homecoming and part of the Jewish Music Festival. David LaTulipe here with Ellie Shapiro. That's some really fun sounds. It really is something. Now, something really caught my eye that's going to happen as part of the finale. It's kind of a big dance party, and some music of Leonard Cohen is involved, I understand.
This is a group sing of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. And I discovered this activity at a festival a few months ago in Toronto, and a couple of hundred people showed up to sing this song. And if people want to get a head start, all four parts are on our website, jewishmusicfestival.org, or you can just show up on the day of, which is Sunday, March 22nd at the Jewish Community Center of the East Bay, and you'll get your part on the spot. And it's going to be directed by the director of Conspiracy of Beards, which is a cover ensemble.
Neat. So that's going to be the great festival finale on the 22nd. And you can get your parts ahead events at jewishmusicfestival.org. Well, prior to that finale, there's more going on than some more dancing involved, I understand.
We have a week of dance workshops by Steve Weintraub, who's one of the leading international specialists of Jewish dance, an art form that almost died out with the Holocaust. This would have been dancing that would have been done to music that sounds like klezmer music. And so we've got a week of workshops at the Jewish Community Center of the East Bay starting March 17th, and then it's 18th and 19th, and then the 22nd is a dance party with Voretsky Pass, which is an internationally renowned traditional klezmer ensemble. Before that, though, if I can just let people know that cantor Jack Mendelson, if people want a touch of traditional liturgical Jewish music, is going to be Saturday, March 7th at Temple Sinai in Oakland, it's going to be traditional, but also with an edge, because Frank London, a founding member of the Klezmatics, is the artistic director of that project, and he's going to be with Glenn Hartman, who's a founding member of the New Orleans Klezmer All-Stars, so, and Anthony Coleman, who's a wonderful jazz pianist from New York, and Cookie Siegelstein from Voretsky Pass. So it's going to be a mix of cantorial music and cantorial music in a new way.
Neat.
And one more
Please.
To also tell people about is Sway Machinery. It's a CD release party at Leo's on Tuesday, March 10th. Jeremiah Lockwood, people might know him from Balkan Beatbox, and he's somebody else who takes cantorial music and mashes it with, in his case, the blues and music from Mali. So Afrobeat and cantorial music come together in his very innovative musical mind.
Neat. Another event that really caught my eye was the a West Coast premiere by the group Diwan Zaz. Tell us a little bit about this group. It's a Jewish-Muslim-Christian ensemble out of Israel. What do you know about Diwan Zaz?
Yes, direct from Israel, and they do music from throughout the Middle East. And what's particularly exciting about this group is that it includes a 14-year-old Bedouin singer named Mohammed Gadir, who will be singing Bedouin folk songs and has a voice that is out of this world. And if people want to check him out, go to the website, Diwan Saz.
That's D-I-W-A-N-S-A-Z.
And also jewishmusicfestival.org. You can also hear them.
Right, and we'll have a link at our website as part of Open Air to all of these events.
Great, and then that will be Saturday, March 14th at 8:30 p.m. at First Congregational Church in Oakland.
Well, Ellie, it looks like you've done stalwart work for this festival and the number of them before. Congratulations on this festival, and
Thank
we wish you a wonderful opening concert tonight. And we're actually going to go with some of the music of Diwan Zaz now to whet your appetite for their performance on the 14th of March at First Congregational Church in Oakland. Here is their, they're performing here, My Heart's Delight, music of Diwan Zaz. That'll be part of the Jewish Music Festival, jewishmusicfestival.org for more information. Thanks for being here, Ellie.
Thank you very much.
Diwan Zaz, the Jewish-Muslim-Christian ensemble out of Israel. You can hear their West Coast premiere on Saturday, March 14th, as part of the Jewish Music Festival, which is running now through the 22nd. Information at jewishmusicfestival.org. David LaTulip here now with Janos Garabin for our final segment of this week's Open Air for a discussion of all things ballet. Welcome back, Janos.
Thank you. And unrehearsed that we are, I hope to spring a surprise on you.
Oh, okay. Well,
you have to cooperate, of course, by giving a surprising answer.
Okay, I cannot marry you, Janos. I'm sorry.
All right. One takes, one licks. The question is for you, that marinated that you are in music, what was the last ballet you saw?
I can answer that quite easily. I saw Shinji Eshima's marvelous Raku.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. That's not the right answer. The right answer is, I haven't been to the ballet years.
I know where you're going with this. I know
exactly. You really picked a good one. Did you see this season, the repeat, the encore performance, or the one, the original?
I saw the original, and then I saw just the most recent one.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
Oh, yeah, it really is something. Great. Very, very moving. But what you're saying is that a lot of people don't make that jump across
Grove
Street.
It's a little similar to people watching being movie fans, but refusing to watch the really good movies from
black and white films.
Asia because of the subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way, there's a disconnect between a large segment of symphony opera audiences on the one hand and ballet audiences. I know just from personal experience, many friends who are, you know, at the symphony every night, I invite them to the ballet and they say, nah, no, not really.
Well, see, it's important here to realize, too, that the San Francisco Ballet in particular has a phenomenal live orchestra. A lot of people may be thinking if they go to the ballet, they're just going to hear some recorded music, which they rarely do. This is a top-notch orchestra, a lot of which is composed of the San Francisco opera musicians.
Unrehearsed that we are, you just stole my thunder. Thank you very much.
Well, let me get back to your earlier point about people coming to the ballet from the symphony. One of my problems, and my partner Ron's problem with it, is that you'll often see advertised for ballet Romeo and Juliet. Well, that's great. Is it Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet? I'm more interested in the music behind it than the dance, and yet, you know, the music seems to take a second
space. Well, there's a very simple answer to that. It's always the Prokofiev. Both sides of Grove, it's Prokofiev all the time. The problem may be, I mean, one end, those who are comfortable focusing on the music in Davis Hall feel that their attention is divided in the opera house. And that's why I mentioned the subtitles that, you know, you have to read and listen and watch. But also people who are at the ballet usually don't pay too much attention to those people in the pit. And, of course, there's an actual physical difference between the symphony, people on stage, and the ballet and opera with the musicians in the pit. I have a difficult time. I always mention outstanding solos, but I have a difficult time figuring out who did that. The thing about appreciating music is that the incredible contribution of musicians to the ballet. For example, right now, there is a Jerome Robbins piece at which Roy Bogus plays 1 hour of Chopin. And if he did that across the street, he would get a standing ovation.
No, true enough.
The involvement of the ballet with music is really tremendous. In addition to the classics, I got my introduction to Stravinsky from George Balanchine in New York. And some of Stravinsky's scores are hardwired in my mind with the ballets. Locally, Val Caniparoli and Yuri Posokov use great and often little-known music for their works. Caniparoli's Ophelia Pas de Deux, for example, was the first time I really heard Martinu the way it was presented. Caniparoli has also used Bartók, Shostakovich, Handel, Michael Nyman, Michael Torke, Charlie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos Surinach, John Adams, and many, many more.
Right.
I mean, it's fantastic.
Well, we're talking primarily about the San Francisco Ballet season, where we're already into programs 3, 4,
right.
5, and 6.
And program 3, you can hear Schubert at double speed. So if we give a taste from the last movement.
Here we are. Taste of Schubert 9 featured as part of Program 3 at the San Francisco Ballet. Now, everyone needs to make time to make it to the Shostakovich
yes,
trilogy.
Yes, absolutely.
My gosh.
Let me just mention that the Schubert is being used in the William Forsythe Vertiginous Thrill of Exactitude, which is part of Program 3. On Program 4, 5, let's go to Shostakovich. It's wonderful, wonderful program. Program 6, April 8th through the 19th, Alexei Ratmansky's Shostakovich Trilogy. The first, it's three pieces all evening. It's only Shostakovich. The Ninth Symphony, the second part of the ballet is the Rudolf Barshai orchestration of Shostakovich's Eighth String Quartet, and then ending the trilogy with the Piano Concerto No. 1, a 1933 score, which is, you know, hard to recognize. Hmm. Do you have something from the Shostakovich?
We do indeed, but not before we tell people to get more information at sfballet.org for the entire rest of the season. And I want to thank Janosz Garabin for having such a well-rounded approach to his musical and cultural background, not only enjoying the opera and the ballet, but the orchestra. And I'm sure you might be seen around this weekend for things happening with otherminds.org. Their big 20th anniversary festival is happening this weekend. Charles Amerkanian, the genius behind all that, a reminder that we broadcast music from Other Minds every Friday evening at 11 p.m. This Other Minds 20 of new festival of new music, 6th, 7th, and 8th this weekend. Another wonderful weekend of music I'm going to be missing while strapped on a snowboard going down the mountains of Utah. Oh, well. It's the festival this year is at the SF Jazz Center, otherminds.org, for more information. Also, the great violinist Glenn Dichterow is with the New Century Chamber Orchestra this weekend, doing a program with featuring Brahms, Mozart, and Grieg, NCCO.org, for more information about that concert that I'm also missing this weekend. Also, Kitka is going to be live at Mission Blue down in Brisbane. More information there at missionblue.org. Live at missionblue.com. Janosz, thanks for coming in. We are going to go out with a little bit of music from Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony, featured as part of the Shostakovich presentation at the SF Ballet.
Actually, it's the orchestration of the Eighth String Quartet, I believe. Let's hear it and then decide.
On that lovely piccolo solo, which is indeed a challenge to play, I know from wonderful experience. You'll hear the wonderful San Francisco Ballet Orchestra perform that as part of the Shostakovich Trio this spring, sfballet.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. My thanks to Niels Swinkels, as ever, for his stalwart work preparing the calendar and herding the cats here in and out of the studio. Thank you, Niels. A reminder that all of our programs are archived at our website, kalw.org. If you've got a performing arts group that you'd like featured on the show, drop me an email, david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening.